It's been almost 3 months since hundreds of families on Kauai and East Honolulu took the brunt of a flash flood. With an official disaster declaration, the federal government is allowing those affected to apply for grants and low-interest loans to rebuild. The deadline is August 27th. And joining us in studio this morning is Dolph DeMont, FEMA's federal coordinator for the flood relief program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Now, refresh our memory, because the flood stories were top of mind, and then we had the volcano happen. And so What's the latest count on the number of people affected?
Well, let me go back a little bit and talk about the April storms. Three days, April 13th through 16th, were just massive rainstorms and flooding and landslides occurring here, mainly in Honolulu area and over in Kauai. So those storms people were isolated, the communities were isolated, the power was out. It was, you know, it was a very severe storm for hundreds and hundreds of people. So when the governor requested that disaster declaration, it was declared on May 8th. That was the day I arrived and started working on the public assistance side, which is the infrastructure damage and reimbursement for costs associated with the emergency response. But although at that time we didn't receive the individual assistance, it was determined that it was not above the capability of the state to respond. Governor appealed, and his appeal, in that appeal, they identified a considerable amount of new damages to the homes and really painted a very good picture of the impacts. And that appeal was approved, and it came in on June 27th, presidential declaration. So that opened the doors to individual assistance for homeowners and renters and small businesses, and it's a whole new opportunity to recover some of the costs of that incurred during the damage from the damages of the storm.
Yeah, but my recollection was it was like around 500 people that were affected, maybe homeowners, I don't know. What's your sense?
Actually, that appeal, the governor identified 760 homes that had impact, and a lot of those were majors, destroyed. Those homes, basically on Kauai, I forgot the breakdown on Kauai and Honolulu County, but those homeowners are the ones we're trying to reach and get them registered for FEMA aid as soon as possible. So we're making every effort we can to reach at least those 760 homeowners. We have 532 registrations to date. We've been open for almost 2 weeks. $800,000 approved for these individual homes, that, you know, with the average check being around $6,000. Dollars, which, you know, that can help a lot for people that had to, repair their homes.
And relocate somewhere else,
somewhere else. It could pay for rental assistance.
Right, because I know of somebody that we talked to who said that, you know, his family was up in a hotel.
Yes.
And so that money could help offset those bills.
Absolutely. The receipts from the hotel can be used. The key is to make sure that you register. And a lot of people, I have to point out that a lot of people think, when they registered for Red Cross or one of the state agencies, that they're registered for FEMA. And I want to make that clear that they're not registered with FEMA, and they really should take the time to visit one of our disaster recovery centers or to register online or call our 1-800-621-3362. 1-800, that's 1-800-621-FEMA.
Okay. And those centers are open so that folks need to go down there this week, they can do that. They have questions that they have.
Yes, that's the best way to actually get all your questions answered, because you can meet face-to-face with our experts, the individual assistance experts. We have a disaster recovery center open at Hanalei Elementary School over in Kauai, and in Oahu, Aina Haina Elementary School. And they're open from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. So really highly encourage everyone to go visit one of these centers. And if not, call. Don't wait for the deadline. Please call and register on the 800 number or online at disasterassistance.gov.
With that deadline, you have to have all your ducks in a row. You've got to have all your paperwork in, pictures, video.
Yeah, you have to have all the required documents entered in, and then so the deadline is actually August 27th. So we still have some time, but we don't want everybody to wait. You know, the earlier you get registered, the faster you get your check, and that's what we want to encourage people to do.
Right. So the fear though is that people mistakenly might just assume, oh yeah, the city knows that I was affected. The state knows I was affected. But
thank you,
FEMA. You've got to be able to apply and use their forms and register to be counted in this.
Exactly. That's one of the main points. The other is that I know there are several hundred people that were impacted that still haven't registered, and you know, this helps to get the message out. If you have any doubts, you know, a lot of people already far along the road to recovery. But if they kept receipts and they have pictures of the damages, this is a chance to get reimbursed for some of those costs.
And your team has been out here. You mentioned you're from the Seattle area, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And you've got folks from all over helping to process the victims, not just from the flood, but also the lava as well on the Big
Island.
Exactly.
We have almost 200 people on the ground all together on three islands. Processing individual assistance and public assistance for both islands, for both disasters.
So you're here until further notice.
I love it here. I'm so happy. Well, anytime we can help people recover from a disaster, it's very, very satisfying. And it's the best job in the world.
Right. I mean, and there are a lot of folks that really were just taken by surprise with the rain that we got and the areas that were affected that, you know, I remember seeing those waves on Kalani-Aniole Highway, and that was pretty amazing.
Can I just make a point? This was a model of the partnership between the county and the state and the governor's office and Hawaii
HIEMA.
Emergency
mm-hmm.
Management, HIEMA. In fact, we're doing a case study trying to capture everything because it was such a picture of whole community coming together, neighbor helping neighbor, the agencies working together before FEMA was even involved. And that's kind of what we're promoting and hoping we'll see everywhere. So a lot of credit to everyone from the county level and the governor's office and HIEMA for that amazing, amazing response during the early phases of that disaster.
Right. Again, so if folks were affected, and we're not just talking residences here, we're talking businesses.
Businesses and the Small Business Administration, we partner with them, and they're located in the disaster recovery centers, and you can get very low interest loans. So we want to encourage homeowners and businesses to register with the Small Business Administration, because one point is the maximum grant that you can ever get from FEMA is $34,000. That's not going to make you whole after disaster. But through a loan with a Small Business Administration, and maybe the combination of the grant and the loan could possibly bring you back whole, back to the pre-disaster conditions.
Right, and it's really hard to believe. I mean, it's been 3 months, but like I said, we talked to folks who thought it would be 6 months before they would be back in their homes again.
Yeah.
So it's just really trying times.
Really, yeah, and it's a tough situation for a lot of people, and I hope we can help them a little bit on the road to recovery.
Okay, so the main thing is to get the gap group in there. You don't want to not register if you're eligible for funds.
Yes, we really want to spread the word and get everyone registered that had any kind of damages from the floods. Just go into a DRC or call online. I make the disasterassistance.gov online or call 1-800-621-FEMA.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and we hope that people out there take advantage of this. Dolph DeMont is the federal coordinator for FEMA. The centers where people can apply for the flood relief programs just opened this week. For links to those locations, you can check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaii Island real estate sales see a post-volcano increase as insurance payments come in. But first, your quiz.
For today's quiz, we're thinking of Big Island's 20th century rodeo and ranching queen, Anna Perry Fisk. Anna was born in 1900 and grew up on the slopes of Kohala Mountain. The daughter of William M.S. Lindsay, a prominent rancher, Anna learned both the skills needed to manage her family's extensive ranch land and the etiquette expected of young women of her time. This balancing act earned her the title of the First Lady of Ranching. Before she died in 1995, Anna gave her property to the community with the hope that it would be turned into a heritage center. Today, the restored ranch house and surrounding land is listed as a historical site in both the Hawaii State Registry and the National Registry. For today's backyard quiz, what year was Anna Ranch placed on the National Registry of Historic Places? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Westin Hapuna Beach Resort on Hawaii Island, a renewed resort on the Kohala Coast featuring an 18-hole golf course and two pools overlooking the bay. WestinHapunaBeach.com.
The Hawaii Island real estate market, like so many other things there, has been disrupted by the Kilauea eruption that has destroyed hundreds of homes. Displaced homeowners are besieging an already crowded real estate market, even as they pay closer attention to geologists' maps of the volcano's rift zones. HPR Hawaii Island reporter Sherry Bracken has been talking with realtors in the Puna District, and she joins us now by phone. Hi, Sherry.
Good morning. Aloha, Chris.
This is the traditional supply-demand relationship. The balance has been knocked out of whack, hasn't it?
Well, I spoke with realtor Mary Bajir yesterday, and she's actually been selling homes for about 34 years. And she said before this, we already had a housing shortage, which was really obvious, but this lava flow has just made it worse. So, yes, the supply-demand model is in full swing. Prices are going up, she said. Sales are happening far faster. She said in some cases homes are on the market for literally hours before they get a good offer, oftentimes full price and sometimes more than full price.
That's amazing. Is part of that insurance payments have been paid off?
Well, that's when I had spoken with Kehau Costa, who's with the Hawaii Island Board of Realtors in Hilo a couple weeks ago. That's what she said they were seeing, that people were getting their insurance payments and actively looking because obviously they cannot go back to the homes they lost in the lava. So yes, that's having an effect. And as Mary said, though, we already had a housing shortage, so there's more demand. But Mary did say, as you mentioned, people are far more cognizant now of where they are looking to purchase a home, and most people do not want to have a home in lava zones 1 and 2. And it's interesting, a lot of folks may not realize, if you look at a map, and you can find this map quite easily on the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory website, if you look at the map, there are lava zones 1 and 2 in both East Hawaii, the Kilauea Rift Zone, mm-hmm. but also in West Hawaii with Mauna Loa. Although Mauna Loa hasn't erupted for many years, it could. So Mary Bajir said that some people just don't want 1 and 2. Sometimes they're even shying away from 3, and they want, like, Lava Zone 8, which is right across the Singing Bridge in Hilo, the Hamakua Coast.
Which is where, according to that metric, there's very little to no chance, right?
Absolutely. That's Mauna Kea, and Mauna Kea and Kohala Mountain aren't likely to erupt anytime soon, if at all. Mauna Kea is not a dormant volcano, but it hasn't erupted for hundreds of thousands of years. So people are far more confident. And most importantly, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory scientists are very confident. And that's who I look to for a source of expertise.
Makes sense. By contrast, Sherry, the East Rift Zone, where so much of the trouble has occurred, could be seen on 1950s maps of the area, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there'll be a story running tomorrow on Hawaii Public Radio. I talked with Jim Koahikawa, who's a Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geophysicist. He's worked at HVO for about 40 years, and I questioned him about the lava zones, how they came up with them, and he said that in the 50s, he's found a map that reflected the lava zones pretty much as they stand now. He said in the early 1970s, they had perfected carbon dating techniques way better, so they could absolutely confirm how old different lava flows were. But he said the current map is not very much different, if at all, from the 1955 version. So none of this is new news. None of this is a surprise.
And yet, much of the comment in the aftermath of what's been happening due to the eruption has been, couldn't the people in the area have known? And pretty much they could have and did know for the most part, correct?
Well, my guess is that, I'm positive the developers knew, because, in fact, I've referred to this book so many times in recent candidate forums. The book Land and Power in Hawaii, Chapter 8, is all about how developments got approved by the state, by the county, back in those days, just years after the last eruptions in 1955 in Leilani Estates and 1960 in Kapoho, whether the purchasers really realized the implications, I doubt it. Or maybe they did. And I say that because one of the things that Mary Bezier told me, I had heard anecdotally that some people are actually making agreements to purchase lots in Leilani Estates right now. Mary said she has heard the same thing. There have been no sales actually recorded, because that's what she looks for. But she's heard the same thing, that some folks are buying the land or making agreements to buy the land, thinking that at some future time they'll have gotten this land for very cheap. They may be able to develop, to build new homes, and make a lot of money.
It sounds as if, you know, home purchases, and I remember thinking way back, going back to Royal Gardens in the 80s, that home purchases in the volcano area depended in some part on a kind of magical thinking, it won't happen to me, or lightning won't strike in the same place twice. Do you see evidence of things like that?
Well, pretty clearly, people figured it just probably wouldn't happen, and people need to realize that scientifically, 1955, when the last eruption occurred in Leilani Estates, in geologic time is like 20 seconds. It's the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I definitely appreciate the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory scientists being so diligent about this. By the way, one of the areas that is in Lava Zone 3 is Hawaiian Paradise Park. And Mary told me that on May 3rd, after the lava started, some of the builders working in there pulled back because they feared there'd be a huge downturn in the market. But, of course, now they're seeing that there's big demand, so they are back building. And Hawaiian Paradise Park is a perfect example of an area. It's in Lava Zone 3. It's got 8,000 one-acre parcels. And Mary said only 30% are built out. So there is land for people to build, and there are homes for sale in that area.
Even though Lava Zone 3 is still carries with it some risk.
Well, actually, Chris, every place on the Big Island, just about, except for maybe Kohala, carries some risk.
Yeah, I suppose.
But yes, Lava Zone 3 would be a little more risky than Lava Zone 4. All of Hualalai volcano area is considered Lava Zone 4, so that would carry a little less risk. That's on the Kona side of the island. But, you know, it's risky wherever you live. If you live on the mainland, you could be looking at earthquakes and tornadoes and all that, but yeah, Lava Zone 3, I think, is better than Lava Zone 1 or 2. I personally would not look for a home in Lava Zone 1 or 2 just because scientifically, geologically, it is more likely to get overrun again with lava. That's the point of the lava zone maps, understanding that.
Do the realtors that you've spoken to, do they tell you that people are getting more specific about what zone is this in? You know, what zone is this parcel in? Are they more cognizant of the risks than they were, say, before all this happened?
Oh, absolutely. Mary Bajir said on the east side, people are very cognizant of the lava zones, and they look at the maps. Now, I also spoke with Gretchen Osgood, who's a longtime realtor on the west side of the island, Hawaiian Isles Realty, and the properties she deals with are mostly properties under $1 million, properties that normal working folks here on the island would live in, and she did not mention that was an issue, and probably because people feel like they're not at as much risk. That said, you do have to look at Mauna Loa, which has erupted not that long ago into South Kona.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory scientists about two or three years ago raised the threat level of Mauna Loa because there were more seismic tremors, more background activity. They've just lowered that risk for Mauna Loa. They see less likelihood it will erupt. But nevertheless, people do need to be aware of past history.
Well, they're certainly more aware than they used to be, Sherry. That's one thing for sure, yeah?
All you have to do is watch TV any night or listen to any of these news broadcasts. Fortunately, we are not the number one story on the national news anymore, and I'm definitely grateful for that.
Well, it's a pretty good story anyway, Sherry. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Chris. Aloha.
Bye-bye. Sherry Bracken is HPR's Hawaii Island reporter.
I'm Ben Brock Johnson. Coming up on the next On Point, the depth of Russian interference in U.S. elections is deeper and darker than you know. A top reporter who has covered it all reveals the chilling facts. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
The Office of Hawaiian Affairs was born in hope at the state's Constitutional Convention 40 years ago, a hope that for many has yet to be fulfilled. 5 OHA seats are up for election this year, and as the agency continues to be mired in tales of infighting and ethics scandals, many observers wonder if a shakeup is in the offing. Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
OHA has a bit of a reputation statewide, doesn't it?
Yes. Unfortunately, lately, there's been a lot of negative news coming out about the agency, and so there's been a lot of negative stories.
Well, you could look back into prior decades and find a few of those, too, couldn't you?
That's very true. And honestly, since the beginning, even before it was officially created, there's been a lot of criticism of OHA from people who don't believe that there should be a race-based organization. I mean, I went back through some newspaper archives and found a 1978 letter to the editor criticizing the organization, even calling it a monster and a racist organization. But lately, there's been so many ethics scandals that the race-based criticism is the least of OHA's problems.
Well, a lot of the recent news has to do with OHA's finances and how those finances are deployed, right?
Exactly. As you know, there was a state audit earlier this year that raised questions about the transparency and accountability at OHA. And following that, the state attorney general's office actually opened an investigation into OHA.
What's likely to change given that this is an election year, Anita?
Well, all of this comes at a really bad time for incumbents who are trying to seek re-election. And it also kind of dampens enthusiasm for OHA. And some people say that it obscures the really good work that OHA is doing. You know, every year the organization spends millions of dollars helping people with scholarships and grants, helping to fund legal services for beneficiaries on the neighbor islands, that kind of thing. And so when you have this news cycle that's dominated by lawsuits or ethics problems or investigations, it's hard to see beyond that at what else the organization is doing.
And those good news stories out of OHA are routinely cited when when the press does stories about problems that they're having. But there is that recurrent issue having to do mainly with the conduct of various trustees, yeah?
Exactly, and that's really led to a lot of disillusionment among a lot of beneficiaries. I spoke to about a dozen people for this story, and many of them felt and remember that they hope that they felt when OHA was created. Some of them were there, some of them were teenagers or children at the time, and they felt like it was a really wonderful opportunity to finally bring equality to Hawaiians. But instead, over the years, all of the scandals and some of the conduct of some of the leaders there has kind of led to a feeling of disillusionment. And so people are still hopeful that OHA can be fixed and that change can happen. But there's definitely a huge shift in the mentality over the past several decades.
Are we likely to see some new trustees after the election?
Well, we'll have to see. There's a lot of there are five seats that are up for a vote, and many people who are running with many divergent points of view. We actually have been sending out questionnaires to the candidates, and so you can find those on our website if you want to read about their positions on various issues. And they're definitely campaigning for some change, but we'll have to see.
Well, thanks very much for that story, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
And that was reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check from Honolulu Civil Beat. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
It was billed as a Hawaii festival in France. It's only been the third time that Paris Halau put island songs, dances, and chants in the spotlight in the City of Lights. We were long to document the events, and all this month we'll be showcasing some of the ties between Hawaii and Paris. Previous years featured musicians like Taimani Gardner and Makana, and the hula, oli, and exhibits were in larger venues like the prestigious Bronley Museum. But with recent terrorist attacks, the decision was made to spread the events in neighborhoods throughout the city and even in a small town outside Paris. Proclamations by two mayors from Honolulu in France are a nod to the Herculean efforts by a hearty band of those who have embraced the Hawaiian culture and who have rekindled connections first made by the Kingdom of Hawaii in the 1800s. It was an Aloha Friday. The festival kicked off with the feel of a backyard luau, a kanaka pila where you felt welcome with the warm embrace. We were near water, down by a hipster locale where crowds come to relax after a work week. In the crowd at this opening event is Reina Tatsuda. Originally from Tokyo, she's lived in Paris for the last 10 years. She discovered her passion for hula after taking part in an earlier festival.
Actually, I have been here in Paris for 10 years. 2014, I found it actually there is a halal in Paris. I went to the festival France Hawaii in the, how can I say, the Museum of Cape Bronley, and I found that, and I really, and I, it gave me the passion to learn the dance, Hawaiian dance, and also the ukulele as well.
So nice out here in this setting to see the hula.
Yeah.
You know, well, along the canal.
Yeah, that's great. Sometimes that I have the Kami Kapila with friends. We know that with the hula sisters, sometimes we dance and we play the ukulele together. And, you know, I like that.
The festival exists because of sheer determination by Kumu Kilohana Silb, who started the Paris Halau 25 years ago. It's a showcase of Hawaii, old and new.
We're also sharing products from Hawaii, sharing a little taste of Hawaii in the form of coffee and chocolates here. We're hoping that what we are doing is really planting seeds that are growing and blossoming, and doors are opening for other artists, for other products, for all kinds of educational and cultural and business exchanges between France and Hawaii.
Lion Coffee provided coffee under its newly designed logo, and Chocoldea offers treats for VIP gifts. But it's the Ohana of volunteers from Europe and the Hawaiian Islands that give this festival its sparkle. Kilohana's daughter, the little girl, part French, part Hawaiian, who wanted to learn hula, is all grown up and largely carrying on the tradition started by her mother. Vanessa Leilani Thil is shouldering the festival's events. On the list are screenings of films about Hawaii, as well as art exhibits, workshops about laymaking, music, and lectures about native plants and native sports. Yes, surfing and stand-up paddling get the spotlight, too.
What we really want to get through to Parisians and other people who happen to be here, so whoever comes to the festival, is that, you know, the Hawaiian culture is very rich, and it's much more than just grass skirt and Hollywood type ideas of what Hawaii is. So we are trying to give much more about the culture through the dance, the music, the sports. Even surf is more than just surf. Mm-hmm. The cuisine, the gastronomy. But we've been working with some of the same venues since the beginning, like the Petit Bain. It's this Peniche boat on the Seine that's very nice. So we've every edition we've done something there. And this year is a new. We have this new partner with the pavilion. It's a place that opened not too long ago, and it's kind of this fun place, this house along the canal.
How do you pronounce the name?
Le pavillon des canaux. So it means the pavilion along the canal.
You pretty much grew up here mm-hmm. in Paris. What's it like to see interest in hula grow over the years?
Well, I think through different mediums, Hawaii has become more and more popular through ukulele. It's been really growing, and many, many people now are playing the ukulele because it's so convenient. It's a nice little instrument you can carry around, and you can play anything with that.
And there's all kinds of ukulele clubs,
exactly.
Cafes.
Yeah. In Great Britain, there was the ukulele orchestra that was really, really big, and I think that got the ukulele to be quite popular. So now ukulele is played kind of everywhere, so it's really fun. Also, stand-up paddle has been growing, and that's really recent. It's been maybe 2 or 3 years only.
Yes, it's taken off, and I've seen they've got incredible races on the Seine.
On the Seine, on the canal, in the ocean, of course, but it's convenient for people who live inland and who are not close to the ocean. They are able to do some stand-up paddle right in the city. We have a partner with the Le Grand Vite Association. The director is a very interesting person who started in Lille to do stand-up paddle quite a few years ago. And he has classes going on in Paris, kind of all over the place. And so he's so with him, we have different classes that people can follow on the canal in Pantin during the festival and during the summer. So it's a lot of work, but it's fun to see it finally happen. And so moving to have the Hawaiians here with us, Halau Mele, and the members of Halau Hula'u Manoa, all dancing together the same dances, and it's really fabulous to see that happening.
This festival delivers the aloha, and the Parisianers respond with a hana ho. And tomorrow we take you out in the streets of Paris for a giant marionette parade. 8-foot-high puppets, close to 40 of them, tell the story of Hawaii from King Kamehameha to Moana. A visual feast for the eyes and ears. That's tomorrow on The Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. We are so fortunate to tap into the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Saturn rising in the east during sunset and Jupiter in the south at twilight. The moon this week will be passing through its new moon phase, and as such, it will bring beautiful dark skies, perfect for stargazing at any time.
This week you've got an update to an update that we recently had on a new space telescope.
Yes, it's the James Webb Telescope, or JWST. It's the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and its development has been a long and winding road, with this road set to get a little longer, with the launch of JWST now being pushed back to 2021. This has come as quite a disappointment to astronomers around the world who were hoping to use the telescope in March of next year when it was supposed to launch, but now they're going to have to wait a bit longer.
Now, when you say it's a long and winding road, it's nothing quite as long and complicated as the TMT, is it?
Well, it's an entirely different set of complications that involve the JWST. The problem with this telescope is that it is one of the most complex pieces of machinery ever constructed by the human race, and so it has to function flawlessly when it's launched into space. And NASA has decided that they need more time to work out some of the kinks that might occur in critical components of this telescope.
Because once it's up there, there's no messing with it, huh?
Absolutely. Unlike Hubble, which is in near-Earth orbit, more or less, and astronauts can get to it and repair it, as they have done in the past, the JWST is going to be deployed to a point very far from the Earth, beyond the reach of any repair crews. If it breaks, nobody's going to be able to fix it, and it will become a $9.6 billion piece of space junk.
And is it because of that mega price tag that we still have the ground observatories?
It really is. A ground-based observatory costs just a fraction of that of a large space telescope like JWST. Even TMT, for example, will cost almost around one-tenth that of the JWST.
And anything goes wrong, you can just walk right in and fix it.
Exactly. Get your toolbox, wrench, spanner, job done.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fun and enlightening Stargazer Report. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the Molokai General Hospital on the island of Molokai. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Earlier in the show, we told you about Anna Ranch, nestled on the slopes of Kohala Mountain in the town of Kamuela on Hawaii Island. Its ranch house, home to renowned rancher Anna Perry Fisk, was built in 1910. For more than 100 years, the ranch house has been a site of community gathering, from the elaborate parties that Anna would host to its role as a heritage site today. Anna Ranch was put on the National Registry of Historic Places in 2008, 3 years after it was included in the Hawaii State Registry of Historic Places. Today, Anna Ranch honors both the history of ranching in Hawaii and the achievements of its namesake, Anna Perry Fisk.
And Chris, we do have a winner. Ariana Data from Honolulu got it right. Congratulations to you. That is today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
A fairy tale princess finds herself in a very different world in Lisa Matsumoto and Rosalind Katrakia's The Princess and the Iso Peanut, a local-style pigeon musical comedy. The show has become a Hawaii theater staple. It's the closing show of the Manoa Valley theater season. Michael Ng is the director. He's with us in our studio.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you.
And Michael, you know this show pretty well, don't you?
Yes, I actually was in the original cast back in 1999. So it's been almost 20 years. So I have a really great connection with that.
Yeah. Who'd you play in the original?
I played Uncle Masa, which is funny because I was 21 years old then, and the prince, my nephew, was 30. So it was a lot of fun.
You were an older character.
Yes, correct. Yes, yes, much older.
The story and this play is kind of in two different languages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, so we have the traditional storybook characters, which speak in standard English, and then we have the local Yamamoto Kingdom, which they speak in pidgin English.
Yeah. So how do those kingdoms intersect?
The story is that the princess, she's engaged to get married to a prince she's never met, and she's not too good with that. I mean, she doesn't believe that's what love really is. And then you have the prince in Hawaii who... he has everything he wants, but there's something missing in his life still. So the princess devises a plan to run off and escape, and she gets swept up in a storm, and she lands in this mythical fairy tale Hawaii kingdom where she meets the prince. And there's a language and cultural barrier, but they manage to make it work, and they fall in love.
She has to figure out what they're saying when they're talking in pidgin, right?
Yes, exactly, and so does he. He tries to take up Shakespeare, thinking that's what, you know, the traditional storybook princess would really understand. But so they both work at it.
I would imagine they did. And yet at the same time, for you as a director, mm-hmm. you've got to sort of keep you've got to keep these two sides authentic to the sides they're on, yeah?
Yes. Like for the actors, my notes would be, be sure you're not speaking pidgin to the storybook characters, because one of the lines you said, forever, but sometimes they have a tendency to slip to forever.
Forever.
I mean, so right. Things like that. But
yeah,
that's my job as a director, to kind of like remind them to follow whatever the characters or the parts they are.
How did you move into becoming a director from being an actor?
You know, I actually stumbled into it. I lived in LA for quite some time. Moved back in 2010. A friend of mine was teaching over at IA High School, and she was going to move to Korea, and she offered me the drama teaching position, which I had to direct a show. I was a bit hesitant. I did it, and I actually fell in love with it. You know, I used some of my acting, I guess, education, and kind of incorporated into what
did I did. Your acting experience, I would think, would give you some credibility with the actors.
I would hope so. Well, at least I a lot of them in this current cast have worked with me before as an actor. So I guess the trust is there already, yeah.
Which is, it's your job to sort of foment that among the cast as mm-hmm. well, right?
Yeah.
What's preferable about directing to you?
Oh, I think, you know what it is, you have this vision before you start, and then you start putting it together. I mean, I look at it as, it's almost like a 1,000-piece puzzle. You know what the picture's going to look like. You dump all the pieces out, and it's overwhelming because you have all these pieces, you don't know where to start. And once you start putting it together, and then you start getting down to the end of it, and you see the whole picture, I mean, it's beautiful, I think. I think I get to sit back and just kind of enjoy what I put together. I think as an actor, you don't really get to do that. You're on stage, you're having fun, but you don't know what it looks like from out there.
When you were an actor before you became a director, did you understand the things that a director was making possible for you?
Not quite. I mean, you know, you've always respected the director, but you don't know exactly what the amount of work and stress that they have to do. It's not only working with actors, but they have to put the entire production together. They have to work with the costumer, the producers, marketing, everything, you know. So it's not only creative, which that's what I thought it was. Like, they're just telling us where to go, how to say it, and all that.
The auteur kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, at the same time, you're doing a job where it's not that necessarily that important that everything that you did be recognized, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My job is to make it look simple. You know, if an audience go there and they don't really, they just go there and enjoy and be entertained and they don't think too much about it, I think I did my job. If I make it like really complicated and they have to think about it and not really fully understand what's going on, I mean, that's, yeah.
Is there a certain amount of, you know, I guess, a sublimation of ego necessary to do a job where you hope people won't notice what it is you did?
No, not. Well, you hope not. I mean, I figure, like, if they notice all the little things that they're not, you know, the actors are not doing the job, therefore I didn't do my job well. So, no, I mean, it's a collaborative effort, I think. Yeah.
Well, you're also sort of at the receiving end of whatever might go wrong.
Sure, right? Sure. And I'm okay with that too.
But that's a different consciousness than an actor's, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, as an actor, I think you kind of, you know, you put it out there and you hope that people like it. And sometimes, you know, I mean, you don't even get the responses that you would expect. So
when you're doing something that's lighthearted, fantasy, with elements of comedy, how do you make sure that the comedy, in particular the laugh lines, work? I would think that would be one of the most difficult things.
You know, it is. And I don't consider myself a comedic performer. I'm more of a dramatic actor. But, you know, you just trust your actors and you make bits work. And throughout the whole rehearsal process, you don't know if it works or not because it's just us watching. I mean, it's stale to us. But once you bring in a preview audience, and that's when you know. And then you still have time to play, you know, and adjust. So, I mean, you have to really trust that you're doing something, portraying the comedy or drama, honestly.
I would think that the danger, as you said, it can get stale to you from repetition.
Yes.
Is there such a thing as over-rehearsing?
There is. And luckily we didn't have that much extra time to really over-rehearse. But, yeah, there can be.
Yeah. Were you working with a lot of student actors who hadn't, who were inexperienced?
You know, no. I mean, a lot of them are adults. I have a few student actors, but they're my students.
Yeah.
So I've worked with them before, and that's why I brought them on, because I knew that they could get to that level of where these adults were.
Yeah. What does it take to get a student actor to that level?
It's just working them. I'm just giving them individual time and making them believe in themselves. Really.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes time. It's practice. You know?
Well, I would think that instilling confidence would be...
Yeah, definitely.
But that's, you know, there's no direct formula for that, I would think.
Not at all. You just got to work with them. And like I said, you know, you really got to make them believe that they can do it.
Yeah. Is repetition a big part of that? Just kind of...
Drilling them, yes. Yes, repetition. And I find that with inexperienced actors, you have to show them. Like, I think that's... Being an actor myself, I think that's, I guess, what's good about, that's what I can do for them. Mm-hmm. Whereas some directors, they give you the note and you let, you know, you have to figure out yourself. But I show them, like, what I mean. So I think for the kids, that's very helpful.
When your student actors have that rite of passage of that first performance,
yeah.
What kind of things do they say to you afterward, aside from, I was so scared, I thought I was going to pass out or something?
You know, I don't know. I haven't really asked them. But
there's a transformation that occurs from your own early performances. You probably remember that.
Yeah, you know, I just definitely see this confidence in them that they never had before, you know. And a lot of them get bitten by the bug, and they want to do it again, and they want to come back. And they just have a really, really good time doing it. So it's a sense of joy that they have that you don't see prior to, you know, performing in front of an audience.
Well, that's got to be pretty rewarding in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in, Michael.
No, thank you for having me.
Michael Ng is a theater actor, director, and teacher who directed the current Mono Valley Theater production of Lisa Matsumoto's The Princess and the Iso Peanut, playing now through July 22nd.
If there's such a thing as Polynesian fusion rock, Tavana is its biggest star, wrote the Honolulu Weekly. HPR invites this original talent to the Atherton Studio on Saturday, July 14th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for Tavana in the Atherton on the 14th. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Coming up tomorrow, contributing editor Neil Milner takes the long view of youth voting patterns.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercliff.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.